It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our Super Bowl edition of Food Friday.
First, Republican members of the House released a list of principles Thursday evening that they say will guide any bills they put forth on immigration reform.
Eyes have been on the House of Representatives for movement on immigration since the Senate passed a sweeping bipartisan reform bill last year. In a Congress that's had a lot of trouble coming together for bipartisan legislation, it looks like immigration reform might have a chance of happening this year.
Here to lay out what the GOP's principles are and how they might play out in legislation is USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this is not a bill that we're talking about here. Why did Republicans in the House craft these principles?
Exactly. These are principles that they laid out. It's been, here we are a year into this. The Senate has already done its work. It's passed its bill. And the GOP has released principles. This is a big step. They wanted to put this out there. It's almost sort of like a way to just start a conversation with their own Republicans, with the chamber. They didn't want to put anything in bill form as of yet, as they say, because they kind of wanted to hear their thoughts. They wanted to talk it through. So this retreat that they were at this week was a good opportunity for them to do that, to sort of start things going, and eventually they think this will lead to a bill that or several bills that they think they can get through.
Who exactly is behind the principles?
Speaker John Boehner's office is they were directly responsible for getting this thing together. They worked with other leaders in the Republican Party there in the House, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor. These guys have been working on this for quite a while, I can tell you, and it was very hard to even put together this one sheet piece of paper that just broadly outlines what they're hoping to do. But the big question there is what to do with the 12 million undocumented immigrants, and I can tell you that that's what's given them the most heartburn and why it took so long to even get to this point.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what is in this document. What does it lay out in terms of a pathway to citizenship, for example?
What it does, and understand, it's there's a lot of agreement between the House and the Senate on a lot of the smaller components that make up immigration reform, border security, granting more visas to high-tech workers, things like that. So it's this question of what a pathway like that should look like. That's been the most difficult thing. And what they came up with in the House, or what they're starting to look at, is allowing everybody to go on what they call a probationary status for a while. So those 12 million would be able to apply and stay here legally, work here legally. After a certain amount of time, that would turn into a more permanent sort of work permit that they can, again, work here, live here. And then the ones who have a relative who's a U.S. citizen, or who their employer sponsors them for a green card, they could then get in the back of the already existing line to get those green cards and begin that process.
It sounds like there are some rules, though, that might preclude certain individuals from becoming citizens. How does the document address undocumented immigrants who won't be eligible for citizenship?
Well, they don't get into that level of detail in that. Some of the Republican leaders, Ryan has talked about this in the last few days, and it's an idea that other members in the House have kind of been floating for a while, wherein the Senate bill, everybody would be able to the vast majority of the 12 million would be able to become legal and then get on that path to get a green card. By doing it the way the House is looking at, only allowing those who have a relative or an employer who can sponsor them for a green card, that reduces that number who can get citizenship at any point to about 5-6 million. So it really cuts in half and really diminishes the number of people who can ever really attain citizenship.
Border security has been a longtime concern for many Republicans. What do the principles say on that matter?
The principles on that one are very vague, but the House has already taken up a bill that was sponsored by a representative from Texas, Mike McCall. And what that does is it focuses on monitoring the border, on putting down more radars, on putting down more sensors so that Customs and Border Patrol officers can better know what's going on down there, who's coming over, where they're coming over, and so they can more quickly respond. And it provides that we start really measuring and getting some hard data on who's crossing over, how often they're crossing over, where they're crossing over. So sort of a more intelligent, I guess, is the way they like to phrase it, a smarter way of watching the border instead of just flooding the region with a bunch of guys running around in trucks.
Are Republicans 100% behind this in the House of Representatives, or are there some rifts here?
Not even close. This is going to be a very, very difficult process to try to get through the House. I could have had this discussion a year ago, the idea that we would have ended up being right where we are. The Senate got its work done, but it's that inability of a lot of people, a lot of Republicans in the House, to embrace anything that comes close to what they call amnesty for the undocumented immigrants. That's the big hurdle that's going to be the hardest thing to get over, because you got a lot of Republicans in the House who, I mean, they just come from districts that don't have a lot of minorities. They don't have immigration, just isn't really a big issue for them. And a lot of them are worried about what happened way back in 1986, the last time that it was 3 million people who were undocumented immigrants at the time that were allowed to become citizens. And at the same time, there was this promise of border security, and obviously that has not happened. So a lot of them are very worried that it's going to be a repeat of that. And so that's what Boehner. That's that fine line that Boehner's trying to walk right now, is appearing tough and figuring out some way to really secure that border and appeasing those Republicans that are very, very skeptical of going forward with this.
What has the Democratic response been to the principles so far, or even President Obama's reaction?
President today just applauded them for getting to work. There's going to be a lot of disagreements on a lot of the finer points. Once we see a bill, the committee hearings on this, I imagine, are going to be very contentious, are going to be very heated. But most Democrats, including the president, responded yesterday and today with just saying, hey, okay, good, we're starting, we're going with this. And there was a lot of fear that the Republicans were going to try to propose something where the undocumented immigrants would be able to get a legal status, but none of them would ever be allowed to become citizens. The fact that Boehner has come out and supported this idea that some of them, at least some of them, can eventually reach citizenship, that was a big sigh of relief for a lot of Democrats. It sort of makes their starting point in the negotiations a lot closer. So there's not that much of a divide, and it's not that big of a chasm that they got to get over.
Speaker Boehner maintains that an all-in-one overhaul is not the way to go. Is a bill similar to the Senate's out of the question at this point?
Well, I can tell. I mean, the House has absolutely rejected that Senate bill. It's been sitting there for 7 months, and they haven't even so much taken a look at it. What they want to do is what they call a piecemeal approach. So wherein the Senate bill addresses everything, border security, interior enforcement, the legal changes to the legal immigration system, this pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. What the House has already started doing to some degree is working individual bills. So like I mentioned earlier, Representative McCall's border security bill, that's been passed through a couple of committees and is teed up, ready to go on the House floor. They've passed four other bills that deal also with more interior enforcement and with reforms to the legal immigration system, and that seem to fit in with these principles that they laid out. Those have already also passed some committees, and so those are ready to go to the House floor. So the big bill that we're all waiting for is the one that addresses that undocumented population. And so what they want to do is take each of them one by one, debate them each, pass them one by one, and they feel they can kind of control the process a little bit better that way. They're worried about these huge, huge bills that suddenly, you know, things just start appearing in them that you don't even know where they came from. So I think this is their way to sort of manage the process a little bit and keep more control over it.
And earlier this week, in his State of the Union address, President Obama pointedly asked Congress to send him some legislation on immigration reform. So what, if anything, will we see over the course of this next year?
Yeah, the interesting thing is he said that, but it was one paragraph in his entire State of the Union address. I think that was for a purpose. I mean, he's trying to give the Republicans room. If he sat there and hammered on them for paragraph after paragraph and pushing them around, I think the Republicans would have taken that a little bit and kind of been a little upset with that. So now what we're seeing is there's a couple of windows in this year that they're looking at for possibly passing this. We got primary season coming up very, very soon, and a lot of folks think that we have to get past that primary season for Republicans who are on the fence, who may support this, but they're worried about getting you know, facing a even more conservative candidate in their primary. So they think once they get past the primary, that that's kind of a little window there where they can do something. And then they're even talking about the lame duck after the election as another opportunity, because it's going to be tough. They, you know, mixing an election year with an immigration vote is a very dangerous thing for a lot of folks. So you're seeing those are probably two of the windows where we could see some action.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
We've been speaking with Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today, about new principles on immigration reform released yesterday by House Republicans. Believe it or not, this is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Super Bowl is almost here, and grocery stores around the state will be hopping as football fans put their game day menus together.
In today's Food Friday, a chef joins us with some advice on what to serve for the big game. Chef Leah Kaplan is in the studio with us. She's the brand strategist for Field to Fork Consulting. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Do you try to tailor any of the food to represent the teams playing in the Super Bowl each year?
Yeah, I think that's the fun of it. I mean, there are usually some standbys, but I'm looking at the Super Bowl as the ultimate surf and turf, or the Battle of the Oysters, Pacific versus Rocky Mountain. And thinking of course, for Seattle, salmon, and Colorado, I can't not think beef and nachos. So sort of Super Bowl standbys, but they really make sense in this case.
Battle of the Oysters.
Yeah.
Rocky Mountain oysters, that's a thing, isn't it? Or did I just make that phrase up in my head?
No, it is a thing.
And what is it? Is it gross?
What is that thing?
It's slightly gross.
Okay. Maybe we'll see. Well, let's hit those nachos first of all. What
yeah.
You know, I mean, there are lots of easy standby ways: chips, mm-hmm. little meat, little cheese, mm-hmm. and boom. What do you like to do to jazz up or add a unique touch to game day nachos?
So, one thing I like to do when I'm having a kind of casual party, like a Super Bowl party, is not necessarily do everything myself, but come up with a theme and then sort of assign with some parameters, so you get something interesting. So if you do, for example, a nacho bar, and maybe I would actually make the tortilla chips myself, but then ask a few different people to bring cheese, some people to bring beans, and encourage them to be kind of experimental, maybe do some ground turkey chili and just keep that warm in a crock pot, and then you don't have the nachos that are delicious for 1 second and then they get cold, but everyone can kind of make them as they like them. And I like to do that with nachos, with soups, with chilies, that kind of style of having people bring small components and ending up with sort of a grand experience.
So that spreads out the labor a little.
Yep. Yeah.
What other appetizers do you tend to think of when you're putting together a spread for the Super Bowl?
Well, when I love seafood and I love oysters, so I'm rooting for the Seahawks. And I love to do oysters Rockefeller in sort of a large dip style. So instead of doing an individual oyster shell with an individual oyster in the topping, I saute some onions and then add a bunch of spinach or kale, cook that, chop it up in the food processor, add a little bit of mayonnaise. That's kind of a little shortcut in making oysters Rockefeller. And then combine it with some chopped oysters, spread it in shallowly in a dish, and sprinkle Parmesan cheese, or if you like, crumbled bacon on it, and then warm that up and just dip bread or crackers. Or
vegetables. So you don't just eat that, you
right.
dip things in
yeah.
it. Okay. And that could be another thing where you ask people to bring different things to dip in.
Exactly. Yeah. I like, there's a northern Italian dish which has nothing to do with the Super Bowl called bagna calda, meaning warm bath. And it's garlic, a little bit of anchovies, butter, and olive oil. And you just kind of keep a flame under it and keep it warm. And you can dip vegetables, bread, hard-boiled eggs, sliced meat, fish. And that's a great thing that really appeals to everyone if you don't tell them there are anchovies in it.
Is it best to stick with appetizers and hors d'oeuvres, or what can we make in the form, in the way of maybe a main course for the football game?
Chili always comes to mind. I'm not a fan of ground meat chilies so much, unless it's on nachos. I like cubed meat, whether it's beef or pork, and just slow cooked. And chili powder in and of itself, that sort of generic chili powder, doesn't excite me too much. So I usually will use some guajillo chilies or chipotle chili powder or the chipotle and adobo in the little cans, just to get some excitement and complexity. Sliders are a fun thing to do, or of course full burgers, but you could do veggie sliders, turkey sliders, beef sliders, and again you can ask people to bring some different toppings.
Seems like given the season and the fact you want to keep stuff warm over a long period of time, this like cries out for crock pot cookery,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's, you know, when the Midwest is really in its culinary glory is around Super Bowl time. And then drink-wise, they're, you know, Seattle, we think coffee. So something I had in Italy, and then I had again in Greece this summer, and you might know it by another name at a very common coffee shop around the world, but it's a Freddo cappuccino, and it's you take either espresso or very strong coffee, and then just blend that with ice and milk, and if you want to add a little rum to it or a little vodka and make it alcoholic, but it's just, it's delicious and it tastes much richer than it actually is.
So if we want to do a coffee theme for Seattle, one worry I'd have is the game is at 5 or something. We're going to keep everybody awake all night. We could get the Big Lebowski fans on board, a little coffee liqueur in a White Russian.
Right.
That would make a nice Super Bowl drink.
Yes, it would. And the fans are going to be up all night anyway.
That's true.
But you could do it decaf.
Oh, yeah, right. I always forget that exists.
Yeah.
In the radio business, that's not a thing. You know, I think about some of the appetizers that I've had at Super Bowl parties, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't say they're high quality. And people whip out the Velveeta cheese or the mini wieners and all these things that aren't, you know, necessarily gourmet.
Yeah.
But it's probably because we're strapped for time.
Right.
What tips do you have for making good food but not taking all day to do it?
Well, the two things that we've mentioned, one is a crock pot. So literally you can do it while you sleep or in the morning and then spend the day vacuuming or whatever it is you enjoy before a party. And then spreading out the work. And that also, you know, spreads out the financial obligations. So instead of having a whole bunch of inexpensive, low-quality food, you can just move it up a notch by distributing the wealth.
Oh, we had a Seattle cocktail. What's I don't know what I'd think of for a Denver, Colorado cocktail.
Well, beer comes to mind pretty quickly, mm-hmm. and certainly for the Seahawks, Washington State wines, sparkling wines, still wines. But you could do like a clementine or tangerine juice or orange juice. You know, you could do it with gin and tonic, which is a nice twist on the gin and tonic, mm-hmm. or of course a screwdriver or just take whole peeled oranges and put them in the blender with a little bit of ice. And again, you have this sort of rich, frothy thing that is really just citrus and water.
So any last tips for the Super Bowl? Oh, wait, cheese. I forgot the cheese. What's a fun way to present our Wisconsin cheese at a Super Bowl, even though our Packers aren't there?
Well, clearly cutting it into the shape of a football.
Oh, okay.
That would be my number one. And if you are a Broncos fan, I would definitely go with orange cheddar.
Okay, yeah, for the team color.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Leah Kaplan. She's a chef and brand strategist for Field to Fork Consulting, joining us today for Food Friday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. As the American population ages, more and more people will need in-home health care or help provided by in-home nurses or aides. As more people need this kind of care, the number of older Americans who are providing it is growing, too.
The number of workers over the age 55 in the home health care industry is skyrocketing, according to some professionals. What is driving the increase? How does the number of older workers change things for the home healthcare industry?
Here to break down the new trend is Abby Marquand. She's the Associate Director of Policy Research at the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute. Abby, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's start with the numbers here. How big of an uptick in older workers are you seeing?
Well, we expect that over the next 10 years that the number of direct care workers that are over 55 is going to increase by close to 70%. So it's really a dramatic increase in that age group of workers, much greater of an increase than in other age groups.
Wow. What's driving the trend?
Well, the traditional labor pool for home care workers is actually pretty much stagnating at this point. So we're not really seeing growth there, but we are seeing an increased demand for these supports and services. So home care workers are projected to grow. The demand is projected to grow by 50% in the next 10 years. So we're going to need a lot more workers to provide those services. And really, because there's just not that many younger workers, older workers are moving towards this field. It's an increasing trend.
What is appealing to older workers about this industry that they're looking to go there in the years to come?
Well, I think for a lot of people, they actually may have a natural affinity for this sort of work, either because they've been caregivers in their life in some other capacity, maybe caring for an older family member or sometimes just caregiving for their children. You know, they have an interest in this type of work. And then also there's elements of this work that I think are appealing to older people, in particular the fact that it can often be part-time and hours are flexible. So I think those are things that really do appeal to older people when they move towards this work.
Let's take a step back a little bit and talk about what exactly is in-home health care. What kind of job duties are we talking about?
Well, it's really a really large range of things that these workers do, but it's everything from essential supports and services like helping people bathe and eat, helping them toilet, all the way to things like helping them get to doctor's appointments, helping them buy groceries. So it's really the full spectrum of things that enable people to stay in their homes even with pretty severe functional limitations.
What kind of physical demands are there for in-home care workers?
Well, it's pretty physically taxing work, largely because it tends to be one-on-one, so it's just the worker and the client, and often it requires things like transferring them from the bed to the wheelchair or to the toilet, helping with bathing and things like that require a lot of lifting. And for that reason, these jobs are actually pretty dangerous. So injury rates are high for direct care work generally. And a lot of the injuries are the kind of injuries that take people out of work for a long time. So there are things like back injuries, other musculoskeletal injuries that, are pretty tough.
So let's say that I'm interested in doing this type of work, but I'm about 60 years old and I'm just not sure if I'm well suited for it. Is there a way I can tell that I'm in a well enough condition to step into the in-home care industry?
Well, I think it's definitely going to depend on the client that you're working for, because some people are going to be much higher need than others. But I think that from a policy perspective, we really advocate that training can help prepare people for this and also help educate them on the kind of skills that they're going to need to do this, and so that they can see if the work's right for them. So there's all sorts of training programs that people can participate in to get a better sense of this.
what resources are available to educate oneself about it?
Well, we at PHI, we have a lot of resources at our organization in terms of training resources, and then we also do a lot of policy work. So if you were to visit our website, you know, you could find a lot of information there, and we're at phinational.org. And that, you know, from us, you can actually find information about ways to get involved in this work.
You mentioned earlier that there is going to be an increasing demand for this type of work. What other factors might play into the need for in-home care workers? Is turnover an issue? Is retention rate an issue in the field?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really an issue. Turnover is a big deal, and it's, you know, some estimate around 50% in this type of work, and that's, you know, because I mentioned it's very physically taxing, it's emotionally draining as well, because you're dealing with somebody who has a lot of needs and a lot of emotional needs sometimes. But also these jobs are just not traditionally of very high quality, so they tend to be very low wage. So home care workers nationally, the median hourly wage is only around $10 an hour. And a lot of these workers are working part-time. More than half are working part-time. So the earnings are very low. A lot of them qualify for public assistance because their earnings are so low. Very few of them have health insurance compared to other types of workers. So really, there's just not a lot of benefits that come with this work in terms of wages and health insurance. So, you know, in order to actually recruit more workers and to reduce the turnover, we argue that the quality of these jobs really needs to be improved.
And the people who are stepping into the work, is it seen as a stepping stone position maybe for someone who is going on to become a registered nurse or some other position in the healthcare field?
I think it can be that for some people, although I think that's actually a pretty small percentage of people that really do use this as a career ladder type job. I think for a lot of people, this is really, you know, the work that they end up doing. And we need these workers. So even if there were enough jobs for everybody to move upwards towards, you know, higher level nursing jobs, we would still really need to recruit enough workers to take care of people in their homes. So really, you know, that's the argument for making these jobs better.
In a lot of other fields, older workers have said that they feel underappreciated or even unwelcome. How are older workers received in-home health care?
You know, from what we can see, it's actually very different in home health care. We see that a lot of times there's a strong connection between an older worker and the client that they're serving. And, you know, and some of that is just because they may have shared interests. But there's also kind of an emotional maturity, I think, that comes, at least for some people, with age. And that can really help them, you know, provide compassionate care to somebody. So I think this is, you know, a place where older workers could be of very high value.
So from the client's standpoint, they may not just be meeting someone who's going to come and help them, but maybe find a companion, someone that they have something in common with, in part due to similar age and life experience.
Definitely, definitely. It's an opportunity to really build a relationship. I mean, it definitely requires a lot of work. It's very taxing work to be a home care worker, but there's also absolutely a relationship that develops between the worker and the client, and that's really important.
We're talking with Abby Marquand from the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute about the rise of older workers in the home healthcare industry.
And we want to hear from you on this. Have you ever used in-home healthcare for yourself or maybe someone in your family? What was your experience like? Are you surprised to hear about this increase in the number of older workers in home healthcare? Are you one of those workers? What's it like? How do you keep up with the physical demands? Or maybe you're considering this as a second career. Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
We'll take your calls in a minute, and we'll hear from an older home care worker from Wisconsin. But first, here's a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the rapid increase of older workers in the home health care field with Abby Marquand, Associate Director of Policy Research at the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute.
We'll take your calls in just a moment. Have you ever used in-home health care in your family or for yourself? Are you a home health care worker? Are you one of the older home health care workers that we're talking about? What's it like? Tell us about a day on the job. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Before we get to your calls, we have a Wisconsin-based home health care worker with us. Her name is Sharon Becker. She works with Cooperative Care. Sharon, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much.
Talk about your experience so far. How long have you been a home health care worker?
Actually, it will be 2 years very shortly. And I love what I do. It's very rewarding, and being able to help the seniors be able to stay in their home is just a fantastic feeling. It's great.
May I ask how old you are?
Do I have to tell that on the radio? No, I'm 64, actually.
You sound not a day older than 29.
No, actually, I don't feel old. I just have the birth certificate is wrong.
Yeah. Well, how did you decide to get into this field?
Well, what happened is, just before I started at the co-op, my best friend was sick with cancer, and her daughter was an RN, and herself and myself took care of her till the end. And then after that, her husband got extremely sick, and I took care of him, like, 6 days a week. He had lots of problems and ileostomy, and so I learned how to take care of the wounds and empty that and take care of all that. And I thought, you know, I really like this. It's kind of rewarding to take care of and help people when you can. And so I decided to apply at Cooperative Care. And I was hired, and it's been the best thing for me. Hmm. I love it.
Is it all similar to what you were doing before, and what were you doing before?
This is a totally different, totally different field. I was in customer service and banking for 33 years.
Oh, wow. So when you applied for this job, did Cooperative Care look at your resume and say, gee whiz, you don't have much along these lines. I don't know about hiring you. And what was their reaction when they met you?
Well, I kind of think it was like, oh, banking, that's not the same. But they knew I'd had a lot of experience with taking care of my two friends, and I think that might have helped me a little bit because my friend's daughter was an RN, so she taught me a lot of things that helped me to learn many things before I even came here, you know, so it was great, you know.
And you say that it's been a rewarding experience
yeah.
for you. What is it about it that is so rewarding and keeps you going?
I think, you know, and hours are long, and they're, you know, they can be taxing, but I think just knowing that you're helping someone and all different ages. It doesn't have to be seniors you're taking care of. It can be younger people that have many needs. And I do have many of those also that are much younger than me. And that's very rewarding also because these people, a lot of them never leave their home. I mean, they look forward to me coming there. I'm like part of their life, you know. They'll say to me, oh, how did those 2 hours go so fast? Can't you stay a little longer? You know, and it makes you feel great to know that someone really needs you and is happy for the care you give them.
Is there anything about the job that you find particularly challenging and that brings you down a little bit? And how do you address that?
I guess the only thing I can say at that point would be the fact when I lose a client. Because I'm kind of an emotional person, and to lose someone that, I become close to these people. I tell them, you're like my family. I don't even see my family as much as I see you people. And so when someone gets extremely ill and does pass away, that, I've got to say, is my hardest part of my job.
Mm.
And I don't know if that'll ever get any better, but I tried so hard to be strong for the survivors also, you know.
Do you ever think that you'll need in-home health care, and how is your experience, how do you think it'll inform your decisions later in life?
You know, we all hope we don't have to have home health care someday, but that none of us know that. And I think that knowing what I know now would help me to find the proper place to get home health care that's good home health care. And knowing what I know, and I feel that that's also a good thing because, you know, there's a lot of agencies out there. They're probably not all that great. I don't know a lot about agencies, but I know that the agencies I work for are very well and very good, and I like it here a lot. So.
For anybody who might be thinking about taking that leap and changing their career path a bit and heading into the home health care field. What advice do you have for them, and what might you say to them to persuade them to take that leap?
I would guess that just the fact that I guess I've always been a person to try to help people and make them happier. And I guess if that's the kind of thing you like to do, then and be there for someone that needs you, then that's what you should get into. And a lot of people I noticed that I've worked with over the past 2 years have been people who are younger girls that maybe are originally going to go on to nursing. You know, this is like a stepping stone for them, you know, in between. And that's a good thing to do, too, because it teaches them a lot of things before they get on to the last part of their life where they're going to working. So I guess I think that, and more so maybe probably for people not quite my age, but maybe in that age bracket, that you want to have the feeling that you are helpful in your life, even though you're getting older, that you can help people that need help. I have no children, so to me, this is like my family, and I feel so good to be able to help them.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for talking about your experience with us.
Thank you.
That's Sharon Becker. She works with Cooperative Care. She's a home health care worker, and that's what we're talking about this half hour. We'll talk as well once again to Abby Marquand. She's with Paraprofessional Health Institute. And Abby, what's your response to Sharon's story there? Is that a common story that you hear?
You know, I think, I don't know how common it is, but I'm sure that there are people that share those same feelings that Sharon does. And I really think that those are the people that, you know, they demonstrate how important this work is, because it's a two-way street. It's important for the client, but it's also important for the caregiver to find meaning in their work. And I think that Sharon just really articulated that so well.
She brought up something I hadn't even thought about, which is the reality that you may lose a client, clients pass away. How difficult is that to cope with, and what's your advice to someone who gets really attached to their clients?
You know, I think that's another really hard part of this work, this work is absolutely undervalued, and another really hard part is that, you know, you are going to lose people that you work with and you have become close to them. And I think that that's something that people need to really consider before they go into this, because I'm not sure that everyone's cut out for it. You know, it can be very emotionally difficult. So it's something to consider beforehand for sure.
Let's take a call from Kathleen in Menominee. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked as a home health care worker for a long time. I've worked both for an agency, which I liked because they found clients and they organized it. Of course, your pay is going to be less if it's the agency getting paid and then you being paid by the agency. I've also done work, gotten jobs word of mouth for other families, and in that way you get to be paid a little bit more. I really like being able to be one-on-one with a client and their family.
Thank you, Kathleen, for sharing that. Let's talk next to Marcia in Madison. Marcia, what's your question or comment?
Oh, I want some of the names of your callers. They're very compassionate caregivers. And I'm an old nurse who probably will need that care soon. But what I'm questioning is how technology has progressed that it might be helpful to caregivers. Like, there isn't anybody that I know that's done this kind of work that doesn't have a crippled back. And my son needed that kind of care. They still were using the old Hoyer lifts. So I'm just curious if your guest is aware of any research or things coming down the pike that might be helpful to caregivers, both paid and unpaid.
Abby Marquand, do you know?
You know, I think there definitely is a lot of technological advances that make this care easier for people. It's definitely more difficult in a home setting to get all of the equipment that you need to kind of make these things happen easily and smoothly, but I do think it, you know, that there are assistive devices out there that really can help caregivers, I think it's a growing trend.
Let's talk to Karen in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen. What's your question? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm a healthcare worker, but for adults with disabilities. And even though it's low pay, I just love my clients so much, so I've stuck with it. But I make $4 an hour more working privately than I did for an agency. And if my client passes away, I'll have to go back to the agency, and I don't know if I can make ends meet. And besides the fact that because you don't need any schooling, you just need a high school diploma, there are a lot of caregivers I've worked with and that are not quality. And they can do as much or as little as they want without being supervised. And I know of people with disabilities who are not well taken care of, and it breaks my heart.
Thanks, Karen. Abby, I think that speaks to something you had mentioned before, that the home health industry could use some improvements in the way of the work environment for the healthcare professionals. What recommendations do you have specifically?
Well, aside from, you know, improving wages and benefits, we strongly advocate for improved training. So what your caller just mentioned, I think, is a real problem, in that there's a lot of untrained workers out there. And honestly, very few states require training for personal care aides, which are the workers that do a lot of this home care work. And so we advocate at PHI that, you know, states really improve their training standards for this workforce, so that we can ensure that there are, you know, skilled and trained professionals that are doing this in people's homes. And I think that that's a really important thing.
Real quick, in our last few moments here, what, if anything, does the Affordable Care Act do in the way of the home care professional health industry?
Well, we're hoping that it's going to mean health insurance for a lot of this workforce who haven't had health insurance before, either through Medicaid expansion in some states or through employer-sponsored insurance through agencies. So we think that it could make a big difference for these workers and help stabilize these jobs and hopefully then improve the quality of the care.
Well, Abby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Abby Marquand, Associate Director of Policy Research at the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute.